All right. Cyril of Alexandria uses the word sarx, the Greek word for flesh, for what is human in Jesus. And while he wasn't against speaking of two phusis, he preferred to use the word one and keep close to the word was made flesh. And he saw Nestorius, when he was talking about two natures, as breaking this unity and kind of making Jesus schizophrenic. You know, a divine centre of energy and a human centre of energy, keeping them two, almost like two persons who were somehow in some moral union or whatever. And he's the man who was appointed by Pope Celestine to try Nestorius. We now come to our conclusion of the first part. In the year 431, there was a council held at Ephesus. It's the third, so-called, the third ecumenical council held at Ephesus, the great centre of Marian devotion, where Mary's house is, you know. John, the beloved disciple at Ephesus, and the moon goddess, beautiful temple to the moon goddess there that had become Christianized and so on. All very lovely. Well, I read it again this morning just to check. It's the saddest page of history. This is the first council of the church that the acts of the council, or many of them, are actually extant. The other ones we've all got, you know, information from writers who were there. But they recorded things in the acts and you read them through. And I don't want to give you, I haven't got time to give you all the ins and outs, but I'll give you a few things just to give you a feel of the reality of the church. You know, and when people sit back and say, what does the church teach? And they're told what the church teaches. It doesn't hurt to see who said it and where they said it and what was said, because it makes you a little bit, you know, not as clicking your heels and ready to jump every time, because the church might be the Council of Ephesus. And while we believe in divine providence, the church is bigger than the Council of Ephesus, I hope. So just to give you this. First of all, he arrives and there are claims and counterclaims. Cyril opened the council. You know, I was sent, so he's got it all, organising it. Now, John of Antioch, with all the Syrian bishops, the Antioch, they weren't there. They weren't there for the opening of the council. I can't find out. No one seems to know. Did John of Antioch purposely come late? He came by overland instead of sea. Did he choose to come overland to not get there? Could be. Was he delayed and Cyril took the opportunity to have the council without him? Could be, but it sounds like politicking, doesn't it? Pretty whatever way. The Roman legate sent by Pope Celestine hadn't arrived when the council opened. Nestorius said, I'm not going to go to this crazy-looking rump thing set up by Alexandria. What the hell? You know, it's like walking into a lion's den ready to be gobbled up. So he wasn't going to arrive there and didn't. And at the main meeting was the first meeting when none of them were there. And he read out his letter to Nestorius, which is a wonderful document, actually, and he read out what's called the 12 anathemas. Remarkably clear statements, I don't have time to give them to you, nor do I think I need to, putting out the teaching of the Alexandrian and what he considered the universal church. The one thing in it, of course, that was tricking everyone was this one nature, one phusis, you know. So he did all that, and they, in his absence, condemned Nestorius and you know, anathema, excommunicated, whatever. Right. John of Antioch arrived to find all this schmozzle going on, so he went over the road and started another council in another building and had his own council at which he excommunicated Cyril of Alexandria. It's terrible, isn't it? But I mean, why not? So the Liberals and Labour Party haven't learned anything yet. They deposed Cyril. The Roman legates arrived from Celestine to find two counter-synods going on in their thing. So they got together and they backed Cyril, because of course the Pope had told Cyril to run the show, so they got on his side and they excommunicated John of Antioch. Now all that mess is going on. Theotokos was defined and the people were racing through Ephesus singing, you know, that you've heard the story. Theotokos, Mary is the Mother of God. And you can just imagine like a whole millions of these Ephesians tearing through. But well, you're rude, you're not sure whether they're worshipping Ashtarte or Mary the Mother of God. I find it quite confusing, you know. But in other words, there's a lot of superstition, there's a lot of truth in it, but on the human, I mean, it's fairly complicated. I'm sounding like a heretic, but anyhow. The best part of all this was that the Pope had enough sense to not accept these counter-excommunications. He did a lot of work in getting them together, and 2 years later, in 433, there was a formula of reunion, a lot of it to do with Pope Celestine, who got John of Antioch and Flavian of Proclus, rather, of Constantinople, and Cyril of Alexandria to get there together and work out a formula that they could kind of find sensible, which they did, so that the church didn't tear apart because of all this business. But that is an ecumenical council. Hope you're not too disappointed.
Well, Nestor didn't get back.
No. Nestorius, I've read some of his letters. They're fascinating. It's hard to get history exact this far away. But he wanted to go because he didn't want to disturb the church. He didn't want to be a source of embarrassment to anyone. And he went out and became a monk and died a saintly life. Lived and died a saintly life. But he wasn't going to... He didn't want to have everyone... He'd rather not be there than cause disturbance. In many ways... It's interesting, the heretics often end up being the nicest people. But that's a human thing to say, but it's a fascinating thing to keep coming up against. And yet the providence and the truth does come through a lot of this. So, okay, Ephesus based its decisions on Nicaea, and it did achieve a dogmatic solution to this problem of Theotokos. Mary is Theotokos, which is another way of saying the bearer of God, another way of saying, of course, Jesus is God. That's what it's really saying. But Ephesus failed to open up, as it seems to me, a theological, speculative way towards solving the existing tensions. And so it really failed to bring reconciliation and failed to achieve peace. It was a terrible failure. And obviously a council had to happen as soon as possible after, which it did, to try to solve all this and to get an understanding below the rivalries of the various churches. We'll take a break and we'll come back to that council, which is the Council of Chalcedon. Well, in the year 448 AD, a dear, gentle, 90-year-old ascetic monk in the area around Constantinople was dissatisfied with some of the young clergy who didn't seem to be obeying the Council of Ephesus in their preaching. And he was fascinated by Cyril of Alexandria's theology of the one physis, monophysite, the one whatever, physis, nature of the divine word, Jesus Christ. So he made this his kind of catch cry of the monks, and he appealed over the head of everybody, his own bishop, Flavian. He appealed to the Pope, Leo, this time, about this terrible preaching that was going on and how they weren't all insisting that Jesus, the divine word, had only one physis. That sets the scene. The next year, 449, believe it or not, but the Bishop of Alexandria, Dioscorus, was delighted with this problem that seemed to be emerging up there in Constantinople and came leaping up and had a synod, which he totally agreed with Eutyches and the rebellious clergy, told the Bishop Flavian that he was doing the wrong thing. He was supported by the Emperor Theodosius and started a whole excommunication thing going again. This time, however, the Pope was on the other side, because he could see that this poor old doddering old Eutyches had missed the point. And Leo is a great pope, very clear-minded, intelligent man, thank God. And so with all this, he called that you might have heard in history, the Latrocinium, the robber synod. All these, they had no authority from anybody. Well, they had their own. So he rejected that council. The next year, Theodosius, who was the problem maker, in 450 AD, died, so that cleared the way. Death seems to be one of the greatest solutions to theological problems. It's amazing. And so the new emperor, in the year 451, called a council, hoping to heaven that they could get some clarity out of this pretty messy few years. Well, so that's the council we're at, 451, the Council of Chalcedon. At that council, there was a tome sent over, called the Tome of Leo, sent over by Pope Leo and read at the council. It's difficult, quite difficult, to get an accurate assessment of this historically. I was brought up with the impression that this was the great thing that saved the day. In fact, it had a substantive effect on the outcome of the council, that's sure. But it's interesting how you do grow up from a point of view. This was the Pope speaking and everyone listening. A couple of years ago I read a book, quite a substantial book, written by the Greek Orthodox theologians. And the impression you'd get out of that book was a little bit like the Pope didn't understand the problem and was interfering, which is an interesting other view, and presumably, I suppose, different people had different impressions on all that. At any rate, the Pope Leo did send this tome over. I'll now read you an extract from it. It was read at the Council and was persuasive in getting the people at the Council together to produce a creed, which we'll look at in a moment. He said this, Pope, the same, speaking of Jesus, the divine word, the same who, remaining in the form of God, made man, was made man in the form of a servant. For each of the natures retains its proper character without defect. This is highly cerebral. Read it carefully and notice some of those. I mean, some of that's excellent material. Each of the natures retains its proper character without defect. And as the form of God does not take away the form of a servant, so the form of a servant does not impair the form, the morphe of God. For the self-same, who is very God, is very man. And there's no illusion in this union, while the lowliness of man and the loftiness of God meet together. For as God is not changed by the compassion exhibited, so man is not consumed by the dignity bestowed. For each form does the acts which belong to it in communion with the other. The Word performing what belongs to the Word, and the flesh carrying out what belongs to the flesh. The one of these shines out in miracles, the other succumbs to injuries. That wasn't a defined statement, and if I were allowed some time, I would like to disagree with the conclusion myself, which is a bit heavy, putting myself up against Pope Leo I. But I do think, I mean, we're talking about the 5th century. I think a lot of thinking has gone on since. I think the last statement is actually wrong, for what that's worth. But the overall feel of it, I presume you can carry, the two natures, and each intact in its own right, united in the one Word. That isn't what I want to concentrate on. I just want to share that with you, because it was read out, and the Pope, the fathers, so-called, of the Council had the Nicene Creed and the Creed of Constantinople, the same creed, and they didn't want to produce another creed. It took a lot of influence to get them to do so. But they recognised that the Nicene Creed was not sufficient for the problems that were facing them, so they set about producing a creed.